I know we often talk about big pyramid, but can we talk about big wireless for a second? If after years of overpaying for wireless, you're finally fed up from those wildly high wireless bills, bogus fees, and quote-unquote free perks that actually cost more in the long run, why not switch to Mint Mobile and keep your money where you can see it? Mint Mobile is here to rescue you from big wireless with premium wireless plans starting at $15 a month. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. And you can even use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number, along with all of your contacts. It's a snap to switch. So ditch overpriced wireless and get 3 months of premium wireless service from Mint Mobile for $15 a month. If you like your money, Mint Mobile is for you. Shop plans at mintmobile.com/aftermlm. That's mintmobile.com/aftermlm. Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month 5 gigabyte plan required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customer offer for first 3 months only, then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See Mint Mobile for details. It's February, which means Valentine's Day and my birthday are right around the corner. It might be the shortest month, but it's the best month. And if you're anything like me, you want the look and feel of luxury without the price tag. And y'all know, Quince is my one-stop shop for luxury essentials at affordable prices. Be still, my little Pisces heart. Quince offers a range of high-quality items at prices that are totally within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters from $50, a favorite of me and Mr. F for sure, washable silk tops and dresses, organic cotton sweaters, and 14-karat gold jewelry. And then my newest obsession, their stylish packing cubes that make prepping for a weekend getaway a breeze. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with safe, ethical, and responsible factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us, meaning that you can look and feel like $1 million without breaking the bank, something that definitely doesn't happen in MLM. Give yourself the luxury that you deserve with Quince. Go to quince.com/MLM for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/MLM to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/MLM. Hey, I'm Roberta Blevins, and this is Life After MLM, a podcast where we work to end the stigma of failure in an industry systemically designed for you to fail. Join us as we dive into the real-life stories of survivors, experts, and advocates, as we debunk the common myths and fallacies of cults, frauds, scams, and multi-level marketing. Hey, Hunbots and Hunbros, I am coming to you today with a bonus episode and something that I have never done, which is repurposing old content as new. But with Mike Rinder's passing on Sunday and the conversation that we had on Monday on Patreon, I felt that we should rerun Mike's episode from December of 2022. Now, I will warn you, this is an old episode and Mike's audio is a little echoey. But the episode still stands, and listening to it, I finally got teary-eyed. So, gosh, Mike was such an incredible mentor and friend in this space. I still remember the day that Mike emailed me and asked me to come on him and Leah's podcast, and the emotional outburst I had, and the disbelief, and the thought that maybe I was being punked. And I reached out to Sarah Edmondson and I had her confirm, and it was such a transformative moment in my life. And I didn't know it at that point, but, you know, I'm very aware of it now. I am so thankful and so appreciative to Mike and everything that he did for me and for the show. And so many of you found me because of that episode on their podcast and have stuck around here with us. And like I said, Mike never knew how impactful his kindness and friendship to me was. And it's just sad when you lose a good one, you know? I send so much love to Mike and his wife and his boys and his family and all of us in the cult space who are mourning the loss of an incredible man. Take this time to enjoy this old episode and our conversation. This is the Patreon version of that episode, so it includes over 10 extra minutes of audio that has not been heard publicly before. I just wanted to share this so that you could all get to know the incredible person that Mike was. He helped so many people, saved so many lives, and really brought a lot of closure to a lot of people in the Scientology and cult world. I know that his impact far exceeds just the Scientology space. I know a lot of you also cite Scientology and Leah and Mike as one of the reasons you realized you were in a cult as well. And so rest in peace, Mike, our sweet friend, and enjoy this episode and walk down memory lane. We'll miss you. Welcome back to another episode of Life After MLM. Today is an extra special episode. It is our month long of holiday magic. And I wanted to share this episode before the end of the year because I think it is so, so, so important. So I would like to welcome to the show my friend, Mike Rinder. Hi, how are you?
I'm good, Roberta. How are you?
I'm doing great. You have had an amazing year.
Yes, it has been pretty amazing. A lot of things have happened and yeah, it's been good.
Yeah. I'm so excited to talk to you. Your book came out a billion years. I got it as soon as I possibly could. I would recommend everybody to also listen to the audio because you actually narrate it, which I think is so cool. I love when the authors narrate their stuff because one, you have this incredibly dry sense of humor that comes across beautifully. I laughed so many times. I think there's probably places where people are going, you know, don't even realize the comedy in it. But like, I saw it, I felt it, I got it, I loved it. The book is incredible. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about your time in Scientology. I know there's a lot of people that listen to the show who are very, very like fascinated with cults. And we talk about that so much. You are the first person I have had from the Church of Scientology to come on and share.
Wow.
I'm excited that it's you. I know, right?
I'm honored.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited about this. So first of all, your book is called A Billion Years. I think most people who follow Scientology understand what that means. But for anybody who is, you know, going like, oh, I know Scientology, you know, Tom Cruise couch jumping. And that's really the most that they know. Like,
yeah.
Talk us through what A Billion Years is and why you named your book that.
A billion years is in reference to the contract that members of the C organization sign. And the C organization is the sort of inner elite core of Scientology, the people who dedicate their entire lives, well, really not just their entire lives, their entire eternity in service of Scientology to achieve the aims of Scientology. And in order to become a part of the C organization, that inner core elite, the people that occupy the highest positions in the hierarchy of Scientology, you must be a member of the C organization. And the contract that you sign when you sign up for the C organization is a billion year contract. That's billion with a B. And it is obviously not a legally enforceable contract, but it is a contract that signifies your dedication and your willingness to basically give up your life to serve Scientology. And that is what I did when I was 18, and I remained in the C organization until I was 52.
Your story is so incredible, and we will definitely get into that. But the billion years is like because Scientologists believe that you come back, that your soul comes back, right?
Yep. Scientologists believe that you are an immortal spiritual being who occupies a body and has a mind which controls the body. And that as an eternal spiritual being, you live many, many, many lifetimes and go on into the future for the unforeseen future and have been in the past for the foreseen past. And it is a sort of a fundamental concept in Scientology that you live many different lifetimes.
So how old were you when you effectively joined Scientology?
Well, I joined Scientology when I was like 5 or 6 because my parents got involved. We lived in Australia and they, our next door neighbor somehow got involved or went to hear a lecture from L. Ron Hubbard and came back home and told my parents and they got interested. And then they sort of got hooked. And so I then was really raised a Scientologist.
In your book, you talk about growing up in Australia and being one of very few Scientologists and being called the Scientology kids. How many kids in Adelaide were involved?
Maybe a dozen. It was very, very small. Honestly, Roberta, it's probably smaller today than it was then, but it was a very small number of people. And these were the families who had gotten involved in Scientology that had children. And there was one family that had, 4 boys, and then me and my brother and sister, and another family had 3 boys and a girl, and then there was like one other family. And that was like the hardcore central child Scientology operation in Adelaide, Australia in the early mid 60s.
So at some point your family decides to leave Australia and move. And how old were you when that happened?
Well, we left Australia and moved to England twice when I was a kid. That was because my parents went to England to the home of L. Ron Hubbard at the time, which is called St. Hill Manor in East Grinstead, south of London. The first time, I think I was 10 or 11. I was, pretty young, 12, I guess. It was 1967. So we went to England and lived there for, I don't know, it was about 9 months, I think, that time. And then again, when I was 14 or 15, we went there and lived there for a year. And I went to school in the town that we lived in near East Grinstead both times. And that was sort of the beginning of my love affair with England and London, which are two of my very favorite places to be.
I've never been, and it is definitely on my bucket list.
Yeah, I love it there. I really do. It's I feel very at home, and I find things to just be very comfortable in England. So I enjoy it a great deal.
So let's talk about you deciding to join the Sea Org and take your Scientology practice a lot more devoted. What was sort of like the catalyst for you to decide to do that?
Well, it was sort of a preordained destiny to some extent, Roberta. Like a dedicated Scientologist, family. I was the oldest son. It was almost like the Catholic Church giving their children to the priesthood. I was, the greatest thing that you could do as a Scientologist was go and work with L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of Scientology, the guru, the master, the king. And I had the opportunity, joining the Sea Organization when I did, to be sent to work, or actually go to study originally, where he was located. And at that time, he had fled England and was operating on a ship in the Mediterranean called the Apollo. He had decided that it was safer for him to operate outside of the jurisdiction of any government in international waters. Obviously, you have to go into ports, but you could always, you know, sail out into international waters where nobody could really get at you. And so I, shortly after I graduated high school and I turned 18, I signed the billion-year contract and went off first to England and then to Lisbon in Portugal, which is where Hubbard was with his ship at the time.
It's really interesting, and you really describe this really well in your book about deciding to sign up and what you wanted to do and sort of how like nothing was really what you expected. Everything that you had been promised was like, oh, well, no, plans have changed. That's not where you're going anymore. That's not what you'll be doing. Was that a common theme throughout your entire life in Scientology?
Oh, absolutely. You learn at a very early age, Roberta, in the Sea Organization, or at a very early point in the Sea Organization, that you are literally a cog in the machine, that your personal wishes, your personal well-being, your comfort, the food you eat, how like where you're being assigned, what job you're going to do, has nothing to do with your wishes. It is entirely at the discretion of the organization. And this is a lesson that every Sea Org member learns very quickly, and it is a lesson that continues to be taught until you finally decide you're going to escape from the Sea Organization. It's the gift that keeps on giving. The Sea Organization is the ultimate taskmaster, perhaps slave master is a better word for it, that treats its people as coins. In fact, that's a term that is used in Scientology. You're a coin. You can be traded for something. You can be used to gain something from someone else. And it is an existence that breeds a mindset that you can basically tolerate any shit, because there is this greater purpose, and the organization has this huge job of saving all of mankind. And so your little problems and your discomforts and your upsets and whatever may be going on in your life are all unimportant when compared to this big picture of the entirety of planet Earth being salvaged from this terrible fate that is headed for everybody. And that makes for a very abusive organization, an organization that can get away with abusing people because everybody within it doesn't think that the abuse is that significant or important. And of course, then there is the other great stroke of genius of Hubbard, which is to say that anything that happens to you that you find to be objectionable, or it hurts you, or it upsets you, or whatever, only happens to you because you have done something similar yourself. And the Scientology vernacular for this is, what did you do to pull it in? So if you get hit by a car, what did you do to pull it in? Who have you run over with a car? And this is where past lives become very convenient, because if you haven't run over anybody in a car in this lifetime because you don't even have a driver's license, you can start looking back to earlier lifetimes to figure out when you ran over someone with your horse and carriage or your chariot or whatever. And that will be the thing that will relieve you now in Scientology theory from the need to be run over by a car. So it solves the actual underlying problem per se. But what this does in an organization like the Sea Organization, or just generally in Scientology, is you can abuse people left, right, and center. Yes. And the answer to it is, what did you do to pull it in? Right. And it's pretty incredible, because this truly is what Scientologists believe. I write about it in the book extensively, how many times these absolutely outrageous things happen. And I start looking at myself going, what did I do to pull this in? What did I do to cause this to happen to me? It's so bad. And like, oh my God. And, right. You know, even down to the point of Hubbard saying, well, you know, this guy's got, this is another one that happens in Scientology. He's got evil purposes and hidden counter intentions. I was such a zealotrous believer in all things that L. Ron Hubbard said that I went, I guess he knows more than I do. I just have to find what is inside my soul that is so evil and bad that it has come to the attention of, you know, the great L. Ron Hubbard, and I've got to use his e-meter and auditing, you know, Scientology counseling principles to uncover this hidden, horrible evilness that lurks within. That's how Scientologists look at the world, and that's how Scientologists look at themselves. And that is why Scientology is able to get away with so much abuse.
Wow. Yeah. Oh my gosh. That is just pure wow. Yeah. I mean, honestly, like Scientology is saying the quiet part out loud. Scientology right. is like allowing space for abuse. They are allowing this to happen. And then when you're like, hey, this seems abusive, they're like, well, you probably did it to yourself. And you're right. like, but I haven't. And you're like, well, then probably like 500 years ago, you did it.
Exactly.
I mean, it's just absolutely wild. It's just wild.
Yeah. It's completely fucking nuts is what it is. It is victim shaming to the ultimate level where there is nothing that can't be explained or justified or excused that happens within Scientology. And that's the culture of Scientology.
I mean, it's exactly what MLMs do. I mean, obviously, cult's a cult, right? But it's like, if anything good happens to you, then it's all because of Scientology. If you're jumping on a couch on Oprah's TV show, it's because Scientology helped you get there. If you're starring in the movie, it's because Scientology helped you get there. If you're getting all these breakthroughs, it's because Scientology helped you get there. But if something bad happens to you, if you get run over, if you get a hangnail, if you forget to pay a bill, it's your fault. And it's because something you did, like, is coming back. It is the most odd explanation of karma that I've like ever heard in my entire life.
It's very formalized karma. Like everything in Scientology, it is considered, Hubbard called everything in Scientology, all of his teachings, technology. Like it is a proven scientific fact, and things are provenly scientific in Scientology. That's really, of course, not even close to being true, but in the Scientology world, that is what you are expected to believe, and what everybody believes, that this is a 100% standardized method of dealing with life. And if you do it 100% standardly and just the way that L. Ron Hubbard said to do it, you will get 100% results. And so everything in Scientology is a very black and white proposition. It's not like there is, it's full of parables and things. It is words that are supposed to be understood and literally applied. So when Hubbard says, you know, for something bad to happen to you, you have to have done something similar yourself in an earlier time, that is a 100% hard-bound rule. There's no exceptions. There's no, well, yeah, except if blah, blah, blah. Nope, it's just that is it. And you and Scientologists keep hammering away until they find it, because Hubbard said that was the case. So if you can't find it to begin with, you just got to keep looking, and you got to keep going, and you got to keep searching, and you got to keep, you know, regurgitating your innermost thoughts and feelings and whatever until you come up with what it was that you did. And this is how all of Scientology is structured. It is, you know, I often say, Roberta, that religions have, you know, all big religions have fundamentalist sort of arms to them. They have the people who are so out there, they are black and white. This is, I will, you know, strap a bomb to myself and die for the cause. All of Scientology is fundamentalist. You have to be a 100% dyed-in-the-wool Scientologist to be a Scientologist. If you're not that, you're not a Scientologist. So it is essentially an entirely fundamentalist organization or group, and that is what makes it a bit of a monster.
Yeah.
Because everybody is like in lockstep. And as soon as you have everybody in lockstep in anything, whether it's a political party or whether it's a religion, whether it's a MLM, whatever, you've got problems being generated.
Absolutely. I'm thinking about sort of that entire, I mean, I'm speechless because what you're saying, like, I completely agree. I'm seeing all of the parallels within MLM and all of the other cults that I talk about. In fact, when I was researching Nexium, I got really bad Scientology vibes with how obsessed and controlling. And it's interesting because in MLM, we get that same phenomenon. Like, you're all in or you're not. And again, cult, us versus them, black, white. It is this all in. So you're telling me that if you're a Scientologist, you have to be all in to be considered a true Scientologist. So what about those fringe Scientologists that are, you know, not in the Sea Org or maybe just show up, you know, come to is it a service? What about those people? Auditing sessions? What about people who are just Scientology hobbyists? Are they not considered true Scientologists by the church?
Well, yeah, that's where you get into this sort of weird area. It is considered in Scientology that if you're a fringe Scientologist, you're just not really a Scientologist. If you're you know, what you call a fringe Scientologist, you're not really considered to be a Scientologist. There is a derogatory term that Hubbard called those sort of people, and he said they were dilettantes. They are dabblers. And he said that he would rather have you dead than incapable as a Scientologist.
I don't know if you know this or not, but our laundry room is in our basement. It's down a tight flight of stairs that freaks me out even when I'm not taking down heavy loads of dirty clothes with me. Switching out our heavy, big box store sized plastic tubs and bottles for our EarthBreeze eco-friendly plastic-free envelopes has eliminated not only extra weight heading down those stairs, but also cuts down on our plastic waste. We are a house that recycles, and you'd think that those bottles would be easily recyclable, but 500 million of them end up in landfills and oceans every single year. That alone is an incredible incentive to switch to EarthBreeze laundry sheets. It's an easy way to get amazingly clean clothes without all that plastic waste, delivered right to your door. Get 40% off EarthBreeze when you sign up for auto shipments at earthbreeze.com/MLM. That's earthbreeze.com/MLM. If you have young kids like me, a new year is another chance to do all of the amazing things that you didn't get to do the year before. That epic family trip, an incredible themed party, checking off a bucket list item, or dare I say it, another year closer to getting a phone. With the power of phones today, when it was time to get Abby one, I was pretty nervous about it. I have to be chronically online for my job, and I've seen some of the worst of the worst when it comes to content that comes across kids' feeds. Luckily, with Gab, there's a less nerve-wracking way. No social media apps, no internet browser, and GPS tracking. Gab devices were built specifically to keep kids and teens safely connected. They are the leader in safe phones and watches for kids, teens, and tweens, and it's easy to see why. As a parent, the Gab Companion app is a lifesaver. With parental controls, message monitoring, safe zones, and usage logs, you can manage their devices and monitor their location without ever having to bother them. And on Abby's watch, focus mode comes in handy when she's prepping and studying for not only school, but all of her extracurriculars too. Right now, Gab is offering $25 off any device with no contract required. Just go to gab.com/MLM to get started. That's Gab, GABB.com/MLM. Gab.com/MLM. Terms and conditions apply.
It is taken very seriously, the idea that you must be completely dedicated. And there are people, of course, who hang out on the fringes, but mostly they hang out on the fringes because they don't consider themselves Scientologists anymore, but they don't want to say that, because if they say that, then their family will disconnect from them, or they'll lose their job, or they're afraid Scientology will start harassing them or whatever. So they just sort of quietly fester in the corner and don't say anything and don't do anything and hope that nobody notices. So those people exist. And in fact, that population of the, you know, Scientology universe has continued to grow over the last couple of decades. And there is even a term that these people use for themselves now, and they say they're under the radar. They are staying off anybody's radar so that they are getting themselves into trouble, but they're not participating in Scientology anymore and don't even consider themselves Scientologists.
So an interesting thing that happened to Abby and I, my daughter, over the spring is we were down in downtown San Diego hanging out. It was opening day of Padres at Petco. And there were so many people downtown. There was a big street fair. And we turned the corner and there are two men on the corner handing out pamphlets. And they hand one to Abby and they hand one to me. And we walk away, say thank you, and we walk away. And as we get about halfway down the block, I look down and they are Scientology recruitment pamphlets with a 200 question personality test. Right. So Abby and I came home and we read the questions to each other. And my 11-year-old, who was 10 at the time, was like, that's a weird question to ask people. Why are they asking this question? And she even recognized, she's like, didn't we already ask that in a different way? Like, she was seeing all of it. I mean, I would really hope so. But I mean, it was so obnoxiously obvious to anybody who isn't vulnerable, who isn't looking for something bigger. It was almost offensive how culty and obvious it was.
Right. And, you know, that thing, that personality test is what they call it, the free personality test, was just invented by this Scientologist guy. It's got no real value whatsoever. What happens is when you fill it out, they turn it into a graph. And then they sit there with this graph and they say, well, you know, you have difficulties with your responsibility level, or you have problems with communication, or you have problems with, you know, there are these traits, they call them. And of course, no matter how you answer all those questions, you're always going to have some areas that are problematic that with great fanfare and drama, they point out to you, Oh my God, you must be, your life must be basically unbearable because you've got this going on and that going on. You may not even be aware of it, but the good news, you are in the right place because Scientology can handle that. And here is a little course that we will sell you for $50 or $100 or however much they charge, I don't even know, to get you started on your road to full spiritual freedom. And this is a methodology that has been used since that thing was invented in the 1960s to get new people attracted to Scientology.
Well, like one of the questions was like your opinions on corporal punishment on children. I was like, what is happening?
Yeah, I know. Well, like I said, it's very much 60s style, and the questions are very 60s. And there was a lot of Scientology that's 50s and 60s when Hubbard was writing all his shit. And they can't change it because Hubbard's dead. So they can't do anything different. They have to stick with the old Hubbard stuff. So he has got all sorts of racist statements and misogynistic statements and things that are just like, oh my God, you can't believe that he actually said that. And yep, they still have it and they still use it because nobody's allowed to change it.
Wow. And that's a really great segue into talking about the next topic. So L. Ron Hubbard dies. Mm-hmm. It's like, what is going on? It was this very, very mysterious thing. And while that was happening, David Miscavige was getting closer and closer and closer to the inner circle. And I mean, spoilers sort of kind of, you know, Bond villained the whole thing and is now the head of Scientology. So let's talk about like what that change looked like and like how that felt, because you were close, you know, Sea Org, you were close with L. Ron Hubbard and you're not the biggest fan of David. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. David Miscavige was, I say throughout the book that he is a sociopath. And I came to learn that really after I left, reading a wonderful book by this professor from Harvard called Martha Stelp called The Sociopath Next Door. And David Miscavige is a sociopath. He is also the product of L. Ron Hubbard. David Miscavige was, like me, raised from childhood as a Scientologist, joined the Sea Org when he was 16. As a matter of fact, as soon as he could leave school, he rose through the ranks to a position of one of the top people in the world of L. Ron Hubbard. He ran this organization called Author Services, Inc., a for-profit company that was created to funnel money to L. Ron Hubbard and to act as a go-between between Hubbard and the rest of the world when Hubbard was in hiding off, you know, in his motorhome traveling around California. When Hubbard became very ill, and he was ill and in bad health for some time before he eventually died, there were only three people or four people that were with him at that time. There were the two, the brokers, Pat and Annie Broker, and this other guy called Steve Sarge Falf, who was like the caretaker, security slash handyman slash gopher. And then in the final days, Hubbard's doctor, a Scientologist, Gene Denk. And then in the very last 2 days of his life, a Sea Org member called the Senior Case Supervisor International, Ray Midoff, who was called to this ranch where Hubbard was living. Well, he was living in his motorhome on his ranch in the barn to deliver Scientology auditing to him, because he was really in a mess. And
well, hold on. So like L. Ron Hubbard has houses everywhere and he's living in a motorhome in a barn?
Yeah. Yep. He, first of all, you know, there's a lot of aspects to this, Roberta. First of all, Hubbard was paranoid, allergic or obsessed with smells and dust and dirt. So he had bought this ranch property outside of San Luis Obispo in California. The entire place was being gutted to get rid of the contaminations inside the house. So he couldn't live in the house. So the motorhome that he had been traveling around on had been, you know, specially cleaned and had all sorts of extra vents and filters and whatever put in it. So he parked the motorhome in the barn of the ranch, and while the ranch house was being repaired or ripped apart, whatever, he was living in the motorhome in the barn, because it was insane the level of sensitivity he claimed to have to dust and smells. He had his clothes rinsed by hand 7 times to make sure that they didn't smell.
Wow.
And this is the guy that invented what he called the asthma allergy rundown, which was an auditing procedure to solve people who had allergies, to solve the problem of people who had allergies and asthma.
Talk about what you're allergic to and what.
Okay. What did you do to pull that in? In any event,
why is ragweed so potent to you? What did you do 500 years ago to ragweed?
Yep, exactly. You wiped out a whole field of it. So Hubbard finally expires in his motorhome. And he had had a number of strokes. He had pancreatitis. He was on various pain-killing drugs. He was a sort of a dribbling, drooling fool by that point. You know, I talk about this in the book and the stories recounted by Sarge, who was there at the time, one of the only people. David Miscavige was not there with L. Ron Hubbard. Once Hubbard died, David Miscavige and the lawyers were called to San Luis Obispo from L.A., and they went up there to take care of the coroner and the police. And because you have to report a dead body, you can't really just bury it in the backyard and hope that it all goes away and nobody notices. So then Miscavige and Pat Broca, who was the husband of Annie Broca, and the lawyer who had been taken up there, a guy by the name of Earl Cooley, who was a very prominent criminal defense lawyer and on the board of trustees of Boston University and a very well-respected guy who by this time had become a Scientologist, went to Los Angeles and gathered together all the Scientologists in the area to make the announcement about the death of L. Ron Hubbard. And the spin they put on it was absolute genius. Because obviously, if they had told the Scientology world and Scientologists that L. Ron Hubbard had died a bedraggled mess, spouting nuts statements with two strokes and pancreatitis and pump full of painkilling drugs, that wouldn't have exactly matched the idea of what Hubbard said from the very first book of Dianetics and Scientology, Dianetics, the Modern Science of Mental Health, which is still the very first book that Scientology pushes on anyone. And in that book, it says, if you do what I say, you will be a perfect human being with a perfect memory, and you will, all of your physical and mental ailments will have been resolved. You won't even get a cold anymore, let alone arthritis, bursitis, cancer. I mean, the list is sort of endless. And then, of course, subsequently, when that didn't happen and nobody was able to achieve those things with Dianetics, he then went on to develop Scientology, which promised now to accomplish what had not been accomplished in Dianetics. And there are now numerous levels that go on, you know, sort of in a step-by-step process of you do this and then you do this and pay us for this and then pay us for that and then pay us for this. And then ultimately, when you get all the way to the top, then the things that I said to you were going to happen from Dianetics, they will probably now be able to happen up here when you get all the way to the top. But there's actually a few more coming. So if you still don't have it and you still haven't achieved that, well, there's more to come at some point in the future. But what Miscavige and Pat Broca did was they stood on stage and said to the Scientology world that L. Ron Hubbard has, you know, effectively, he no longer requires a body, that he has moved on to a higher plane. And in fact, a body was encumbering him from continuing his research into spiritual freedom and the true nature of man and blah, blah, blah. So he discarded his body that he had been using for 74 years, 11 months and 12 days, 14 hours and 6 seconds in this lifetime. And he has moved on to continue his research. He wanted you all to know this was a causative thing that a step that he took. And he did it for you. Don't be sad because He's like the great man has gone on to do even greater things. And this put Miscavige on the stage for the first time with Scientologists. And obviously, because he was the one that was making this announcement, he was the guy. He was the go-to guy. Of course, for Scientologists, if they had actually stopped and thought for a minute, myself included, I don't count myself out of this insanity, they would have gone, wait a minute. You know, L. Ron Hubbard wrote about everything. L. Ron Hubbard did these things he called Ron's journals, where he, oh, my dear friends, I'm recording this journal today to update you on what's going on and what I'm doing, and I've been doing this, and this has happened, and blah, blah, blah. And this was like, Hubbard sent either written or verbal recorded messages to Scientologists from the day he started the first organization until, well, the day he died. All except one thing. He never, in his ultimate wisdom and grand scheme of moving off this mortal coil to continue his research now that he no longer needed a body, he forgot to write or say anything about what was supposed to happen to Scientology, who was supposed to be in charge. There wasn't anything, nothing, not a word, not a peep, nothing from the great man.
Luckily for David Miscavige, when you make everything up, you can just make more shit up.
Exactly. So it was the perfect chance, and Miscavige stepped into that vacuum and figured out how to compromise and get rid of Pat and Annie Broca and anybody loyal to them, and basically assumed control of Scientology and became what he calls himself now, the chairman of the board. And the chairman of the board, even though he doesn't sit on the board, because he doesn't want to be on the board, because he doesn't want anybody serving him with lawsuits. So he is the chairman of the board, Captain David Miscavige, or otherwise known as the ecclesiastical leader of the Scientology religion. And that's his sort of legal PR statement position to the Scientologists of the world. He is COB. He is the man. And he is the replacement for L. Ron Hubbard, who is carrying out the wishes that L. Ron Hubbard had for what should be done with Scientology. The problem is he's doing a really shitty job of it, and Scientology is shriveling. And, you know, I just put a post on my blog today about, you know, incredibly shrinking world of Scientology. Because while they like to say we're the fastest growing new religion on earth and we got tens of millions of members and we're look at all these churches we're opening and blah, 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 it's all bullshit. And this is the actual state of Scientology today, which is in this information age where information is poison to cults, they are dying. And the Google has killed Scientology.
I love to hear that. Google is killing all of these organizations. People are actually like, when they feel that little bit of cognitive dissonance, they're like, well, I guess I could just look. It's not like anybody's going to know I looked. I could just look real quick.
Yep, that's exactly right. And you know, if you Google Scientology, it's not pretty.
It's
definitely not pretty.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Another one of my favorite things about your book, and this kind of goes into Googling Scientology and finding out it's not pretty, is that I've read other Scientologist accounts and that I am a friend in, I haven't seen her in a long time, but I did message her recently, but I am a friend of Jenna and Dallas and their family. And so right. I read her book and your name comes up so much because you guys are friends and Jenna comes up in your book. And so that was one of the things because I was like, oh my gosh, this is the missing piece. This is the puzzle piece that wasn't in Jenna's book and isn't in other Scientology books, because you are mentioned in most, if not all, Scientology books, because you were like, you know, bad dude number one right next to the COB. And so right. the fact that now you are coming out and you are corroborating all of these other stories, all of these other books, you are filling in all the blank spots and the questions. I was just like, this is amazing. This is amazing. You're the keymaster. You filled in all the holes.
Well, I try. You know, it's funny. One person who I won't mention his name, but someone that I admire greatly and has been a friend of mine now for some time, a former enemy of mine for a long time, said after he read the book, he said, "Holy tamale, I had no idea. You are the Forrest Gump of Scientology." He said, I mean that entirely as a compliment. It's just, you were involved in everything. It's like, it's kind of crazy. And it is a bit crazy how many things I was involved with. It just, even just the very fact of working both with L. Ron Hubbard and with David Miscavige, you know, there's not too many people who have had both experiences with sort of in any depth. And so that's kind of an interesting thing about my account, is my proximity to both the leaders of Scientology.
Yeah. And then quick question on that. I mean, a cult is a cult, but what did you feel was more culty, Scientology under LRH or Scientology under COB?
Honestly, Roberta, it's the same thing, because the cult of Scientology is created by L. Ron Hubbard, and the policies, patterns, and practices of Scientology are dictated by the policies, patterns, and practices of L. Ron Hubbard, 100%. On the other hand, I will say, and a few people have asked me this now, well, if L. Ron Hubbard was still alive, would you still be in the C organization? And unfortunately, my answer is, I think I probably would. And the reason for that is that these sadism of David Miscavige, or the sociopathy of David Miscavige, was what ultimately kind of prompted me, or almost forced me, to go, okay, this is it. Nothing could be worse than this. I'm out of here, and then make my escape.
Oh my God, it's the coolest thing ever. Hey guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? Well, check this out. It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. They ship Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. Seriously. So if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever find yourself playing the budgeting game? Well, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive, you can find options that fit your budget and potentially lower your bills. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Not available in all states.
For the first, you know, few years, I still, you know, considered myself a Scientologist. I still believed that L. Ron Hubbard had come up with the answers to, you know, the problems that have been plaguing man since time immemorial, and that the issue was simply David Miscavige and the way that he was going about controlling the organization. It had not been for the lunatic stuff that Miscavige had done, I'm not sure that I would have ever had the motivation to leave because there are all these other factors that pull so strongly on you, your children, your family, your commitment, your, like, I gave my word, I signed a billion-year contract, what about my eternity and all of that sort of stuff. So, yes, I think that Scientology is more cult now, but it's not really that much different. What is different about Scientology is, as I said, the internet and the amount of information that has been made available, and therefore that has forced them to become more desperate and more determined. In the world of cults, when the walls start closing in, many of the people don't just go, okay, the game's up. They go, we have to fight harder. And that's what is happening in Scientology. They are sort of seeing the writing on the wall, and they are fighting harder, and they are becoming more unhinged and more desperate and more crazy and more unbelievable to the outside world. But inside the bubble of Scientology, they are believing that they are fighting the good fight, and they're fighting harder than they ever have, and they must keep it up, and they can't ever stop. So to that extent, the sort of, I'm not quite sure what the right word for it is, but the conviction is in some ways stronger. And the stronger the conviction, the more cult-like it is. So
yeah,
I guess that, you know, though I answered you to begin with saying, well, it's really the same thing because it's all the policies, I think as it's not necessarily just a reflection of Miscavige. I think it's a reflection of the decline of the influence and power of Scientology. And so therefore they're becoming more desperate, and being more desperate, they're more cult-like.
I could totally understand that. And I agree, like, the abuse has gotten so much worse that it really drags everything down. And again, with your cognitive dissonance and all of the sunk costs that you put into this, including your time and your money, like, what do you do? Admit right. that it's all a big, huge scam and you've spent millions of dollars, or do you double down and stick with it and allow it to get even worse and cultier and spiral down and keep that circle even tighter?
Yep. Well, that's the world of Tom Cruise. You know, he's like the big poster child, and everybody kind of asks that question. Well, does he know about the abuses? Does he know what's going on? How can he continue? Just like you said, coming out and admitting that you have been a complete fool and given a lot of time and money and effort and sunk a lot of costs into something, and then saying, guess it wasn't really quite what I thought it was, or what I promoted to the entire world, that takes some cojones. It really does. It's like much easier to just go on and keep pretending like everything's great and it's all cool and fine. And that's been the Tom Cruise route of late. He doesn't talk about Scientology anymore, but he doesn't diss it. He just sort of quietly doesn't make mention of it, and requires that reporters who are going to be on press junkets for movies do not ask about Scientology.
That's telling.
That too is a very telling indicator of the state of Scientology today. It's, like I said, the incredible shrinking world of Scientology. And it is.
Yeah. And, you know, sort of to pivot, and we'll talk just very briefly, but the Danny Masterson trial and everything that's going on with that. And like, I get a lot of people that are asking me about it, and I get a lot of people that are like, well, like, why, like, what's going on? And just like with Scientology, it's part of it is keeping your lips tight and not reporting things, not mentioning things. And I mean, is that sort of what's happening here? Is that why he's getting away with this?
Well, yes, because I think that when you realize that the rapes that were, he was being charged with happened in the early 2000s. The reason that they were not reported, and the reason that it took so long for anything to happen, is because of the policies of Scientology. That's very well documented, even though Scientology keeps coming out and saying, well, we don't have any policies that that say that you can't report things to law enforcement. Ah, the fuck they don't. They absolutely do. And I've written about it many times. But when you are looking at putting someone in prison for the rest of their, basically the rest of their life, and the standard that you are required to meet in order to convict someone of a crime like that, or any crime, is beyond a reasonable doubt, it is pretty easy to create doubt that something that happened 20, 19, 18 years ago is, that there can be no doubt that that's exactly what happened. And so that's a big factor in the prosecution of a criminal case like this, is how long ago it was, and the sort of natural inclination that people have of, well, if this was really so bad, why didn't you do or say something about it at the time? And you can't understand why a person who is in the position that those women were in, how they would react and how they would view things and what they consider the right actions and the things to do would be, unless you have been in a circumstance like that yourself. It's really easy for people who have never been caught in a mind control organization to blow it off and go, ha, never happened. That's not how I would have reacted. That's not what I would have done. That's unbelievable. And that is a big part of the very high hurdle that has to be overcome in order to get someone like Danny Masterson found guilty of allegations of rape that happened 20 years ago. It is also why I spent so much time in my book trying to explain my thought processes and what was going on and what was I thinking at the time. Because I know people read or hear about experiences and go, ah, never would have happened to me. If that guy had walked up and started kicking and punching me, I would just have sucked him right back. And I would have been out of there. I wouldn't stand for that shit and blah, blah, blah. It's the, you know, the boiling the frog story of you become more and more and more immersed in what becomes an increasingly insane Alice in Wonderland world that seems perfectly normal and is all explained, and all the people around you think the Mad Hatter is just a perfectly normal guy, and so is the rabbit, and so is the crazy queen, and everything is just all, that's how it's supposed to be, because they're all living in that world. They're all occupying that world inside that bubble. And for people outside the bubble to pass judgment on that is unfortunate. If I had to say what my thought about the Masterson hung jury is it is my belief that a jury of peers in that case would have to be ex-cult members.
Yeah.
If you had a jury of ex-cult members, which all of those, Danny Masterson is still a cult member, and the victims are ex-cult members. If you had a jury of ex-cult or people who had studied cults or understood cults, mind control, undue influence, and all of those things, then you would have a jury that would be able to be truly determinative of who's telling the truth. Because
yeah.
Everything is colored by your beliefs when you're talking about things like that in Scientology. So that's my response to that. It's unfortunate that that's what happened. I don't know if there's going to be a retrial. I somewhat suspect that there will not be. I suspect that this now is going to go the route of a civil case, and that's going to be a very different proposition. You know, you're going to see a lot more information tumbling out you know, Scientology is running around trying to do PI area control now, saying, well, you know, they made Scientology an issue in this case and they never should have. And, you know, this is just an orchestrated campaign and blah, 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 blah. When the actual orchestrated campaign of covering up what happened comes tumbling out in the civil case, they're going to be telling a very different story. And you have discovery in a civil case that you do not have in a criminal case. And the discovery is going to be, that is going to be a circus.
I could only imagine. Wow. Yeah. So we'll have to keep tabs on that and see how that sort of unfolds over the next couple months. Yep. I have some questions from my Patreon fans and then we will wrap up. Do you have enough time?
Sure.
Okay, Mike. First, the number one question when I told everybody that I was talking to you, literally the first and most asked question is, what happened to the podcast and will it ever come back?
Yes, it will come back. There is a couple of things. One, Scientology kind of got its dirty little mitts in the distribution. Leah and I had done some new shows, but then really what happened is my book started and I had to finish it and then go through the editing process, which is a pretty intensive. And then I have been doing media pretty much every day since the release of the book. And once that's calmed down, I will be able to turn back to that and get together with Leah and say, okay, so how are we going to do this? What are we going to do? And we will keep, you know, everybody informed as much as we can. I know we put out a thing saying, well, it's going to be the end of August. Well, we had recorded a bunch of shows ready to go. They were given to the distributor, and then they went, oh, and you know, we get this, and then we just haven't, or at least particularly me, I haven't had the bandwidth to be able to go, okay, let's sort this out. What are we going to do? How are we going to do this now? What, you know, where are we going to go? Blah, blah, blah. So it's just sort of been parked, but we'll be back.
See, I told you guys, I said, he's busy with the book. Leah's got her show. They're doing a lot of stuff. Podcasting's hard. I bet Scientology got involved. I was right. See, it's coming back. Don't stress. It will be back.
There you go.
Someone asked, what is the scariest thing or point that you ever experienced while in Scientology?
Scariest thing? Oh, clearly the scariest thing for me was when I was in Madeira. That was pretty terrifying.
And the Madeira Rock Festival?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my God.
That was the scariest thing that happened to me.
Absolutely. I agree. Wow. That was wow. So another one of my listeners is reading Bareface Messiah, which is the true story of L. Ron Hubbard. And she says, I couldn't believe how many similarities there were between certain aspects of Dianetics and what I was taught during my time spent in a Wiccan teaching coven who bragged about their lineage and how they had descended from Aleister Crowley himself or some shit. And I've had to unpack so much bullshit since I left the group, not a cult, but ew nonetheless. And so much of the teachings resonated with me, and I'm pretty sure it wasn't indoctrination. Are there any parts of the belief system that you have been able to keep and continue to find value in?
Gosh, I thought you were going to ask me about Aleister Crowley and witches. But any parts of the belief system that I have been able to keep? Well, I think I still believe that I'm not just a body, but that I am a spiritual being of some description. You know, Scientology teaches you that communication is important. Like Hubbard took a lot of things from a lot of places and sort of turned them into and tried to pretend that they had been his inventions. And there are a lot of sort of these fundamental truths that are incorporated in Scientology. Look, if everything about Scientology was shit, nobody would be involved in it. You can't just sell complete shit and have it continue. So there's stuff in there that is valuable. I think communication is important. I do think that some of the principles of how you go about communicating and that sort of stuff are helpful. I think that the idea that it's a good thing to be causative about your life and not just sit around. I mean, in Scientology, being a victim is like a curse word. Like victim is like slut. I mean, it's just like bad. There's no good connotation to it. But I think that there is some value to the idea that you should not just sit around and blame everybody else and the world for your condition. On the other hand, I don't think you should be blaming yourself for everything. So there are bits and pieces of it that if you sort of pull the raisins out of the cow shit, you can find little pieces of value in the stuff that I learned in Scientology. I don't think that anybody should get involved in Scientology because there are a few good little raisins in there. Don't get me wrong, but you know, after 50 years of being inculcated with all of this stuff from Hubbard, I think that there are a few things that are left that I consider to be helpful and valuable.
You know, you did pull the raisins out, but they're still covered in shit.
Exactly.
And then this is a question for anybody who's read your book, and yeah. It is DCOBSCOHB. And that is just an inside joke to anybody who has listened.
It's a very inside joke. Yeah, exactly.
I will just tell you that when I got to that point, I sent that hashtag to everybody I knew that was reading the book just to let them know that I was at that point in the book too. And I laughed so hard.
Yeah, that's some pretty bizarre stuff in there.
That's like that. Those are the little gems of comedy that I was like, it's, you have to listen to the audiobook. I followed along because I'm such like a reader. I followed right. along and highlighted. But you guys, if you're going to listen, you have to. Mike, he narrates. It's great. How do you and your wife deal with the fair gaming and the threats to your reputation, integrity, and your physical safety? Has that lessened over time or has it gotten worse?
I don't know. I guess the physical, like, they don't follow me like they used to. There aren't PIs jumping out of bushes with cameras and shit like that, like there was back in, you know, 2010, 2011, 2012. They certainly have increased the, you know, activity on their websites and smear campaigns and videos from my daughter and various other people. How do I deal with that? I pretty much ignore it. I know that it's a mind game. It's intended to just try and get in my head and make me stop doing what I do. And it actually just makes me want to do it more. So it's not like it's pleasant or I enjoy it or I get a laugh out of it. It's hard to laugh when your daughter is constantly putting up videos saying, you know, I'm the worst person on earth, and I tried to wrench her mother's arm out of its socket and kill her and, you know, do, you know, whatever it is. It keeps getting worse and worse and worse as the years go by. But I don't feel the need to respond to that. I very rarely say anything about it. There are some wonderful people out there, Stephanie Hutchison and Jeffrey Augustine, who have sort of taken it upon themselves on their blogs to defend me and disprove the lies that get told about me and Leah. So I kind of leave it up to them. I appreciate them greatly for what they do, but I don't, you know, people write to me, oh, have you seen this and you've seen that? I say, yeah, I don't get it. Whatever, you know, it's the same old for me.
So I know that you joined Scientology as a child, like 5-6 years old, but do you remember the first thing that you encountered that sort of attracted you to the idea of being a Scientologist?
I guess it was really those friends, the Scientology kids. That was like my first experience with, you know, I was very young, but that was an experience with people who shared a common interest and they were good friends and we did fun stuff together. Even the fun stuff was the fun stuff that we did in Scientology was kind of fun, you know. Doing training routines and bull baiting as a kid was a lot of fun. I mean, it was crazy. I think that activity is enormously dangerous and no one should ever get involved in it. But it's sort of like if I'd been playing with fireworks with them when I was a kid, it probably would have been fun too, but I wouldn't recommend it to anybody.
And then finally, the last question from my Patreon, and we sort of covered this, but do you think there would have been as big of a fallout and loss of followers if Dave hadn't taken over so quickly after Hubbard's death?
No, I think that he has accelerated that and that, you know, I don't know. It's a hard question to answer because it's so hypothetical, because I can also look at it and go, well, what he did getting IRS tax exemption had a huge impact on Scientology for some time, and I think had a significant impact on its growth. I think that legitimized Scientology like nothing before it had, and that resulted in more people getting involved. And that was the drive and the attack the attacker and the never give up and the determination that David Miscavige is sort of renowned for. So subsequent to that, his kooky programs of buying buildings and renovating them and et cetera, and like I said, the internet, I don't know. It's a bit of a toss up. I think the contraction is accelerating because of him now, but maybe if you had looked over the 25 years that it's been, that it wouldn't have gone up and now it's declining fast. It would have just sort of stayed a steady hum of maybe some slight growth in the first 10 years after Hubbard's death and then contraction subsequently.
That's actually a really interesting point. Like linearly, it might like have the same amount of loss had Miscavige not come in, but he adds this sort of like catfish spike to keep everything interesting. And that growth and then subsequent loss, it could just be because of him. And we're seeing a bigger loss because of that amount of growth.
Exactly.
That's an interesting theory, actually.
I'm full of interesting theories, Roberta.
Right?
You want interesting theories. I'm your guy.
Yeah, I got a lot of theories too. I'm like, this is going to send me on another theory rabbit hole.
Oh, dear.
Well, thank you so much, Mike, for coming on and hanging out and having this chat with me. I'm so glad that my first Scientology episode was with you. Yes, please let everybody know where they can find you, how they can get your book, and where they can follow you so that we can keep up.
Well, they can get my book anywhere. I mean, obviously, you can buy it on Amazon or you can go to Barnes & Noble or Books A Million or wherever. Basically, people tend to follow me on my blog, which is mikerindersblog.org. I put a posting up there every day. Some of them are less interesting than others. And, you know, that's a bit of a pain in the ass keeping that going every day. But, you know, there's always something that needs to be said or something that I find to say. And, you know, I'm on Twitter and Instagram and you know, Facebook, although Facebook, I really have a hard time trying to navigate my way through that crazy world anymore. It's just like become so complicated. And now Twitter seems to be becoming weird and
it's the new Facebook. You know,
whatever. Anyway, I'm on social media and on my blog, and you can send me emails at my blog. I look at them every now and then. I mean, I got to be honest, Roberta. People send me direct messages on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and emails to my blog and this and that. And I have so many of them. Many times I just can't even get to read them all, let alone answer. But eventually I get around to them and I do read them. And even if people don't get answers, know that I do actually read everything. but it's a lot. And I don't have a unit like L. Ron Hubbard had to write letters on his behalf in response to his fan mail. So you just gotta like hope that maybe you send me something that, that attracts my attention enough that I go, oh God, I gotta answer this.
I mean, that's what happened to me. So it works.
I know.
Right. Hey, look, I also want to thank you so much for being so candid about your struggle with content creation and answering messages, because I feel less alone right now.
It's a real thing. I feel guilty and I feel bad about it. But I'm not going back onto a COG schedule in order to respond to emails. I just can't do it. Sorry, everyone.
I feel the same way. And I also feel like our fans, there's a large overlap. They're also very understanding of like, they were in colds. It's cool if it takes them a while to get back to us. I mean, I'll get a message and Instagram will be like, oh, you have a new message. And I'll look at it and there'll be like 25 other messages from the year that they've responded to my stories or they're sending me links to things. And my message is, oh my God, I am so sorry I missed all of these. Like that is always my first. So yes, I feel less alone. Thank you. You guys know, there's no schedule. If we don't answer you, message us again and maybe we'll see you at that time.
Exactly. There you go. Perfect.
Thank you.
You can be my spokesperson.
Sure. Yeah. All the way. And I will say, after reading your book and I sent you a message, I was like, I might have to make an edit here. I might need a Mike Rinder is my spirit animal shirt now, because wow, I related to so much of your story, and thank you so much for telling it. So being so candid today and sharing this, you are incredible, Mike. Thank you for being a friend.
You're very welcome, Roberta. And I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for listening to Life After MLM. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. And follow us on social media at Life After MLM Podcast or visit our website at lifeaftermlmpod.com. And don't forget to check out our Patreon for exclusive content and join the community on Discord. You can find all of the links to follow in our show notes. Life After MLM is produced by Roberta Blevins. Audio editing is done by the lovely Kayla Craven. Video editing by the indescribable RK Gold. And Michelle Carpenter is our triple emerald princess of robots. If you have a story about a cult, fraud, scam, or MLM and want to be on the show, please hit us up. We would love to help you tell your story and start your healing journey in life after MLM. See you next time, Hunts.